Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit WholeFoodsMarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, and welcome to A Hungry Society. I'm Korsha Wilson, and this is the show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. Today's guest is Tracy Chang, chef and owner of Pegu in Cambridge, outside of Boston, serving Japanese tapas. Chef Chang is a graduate of Boston College and Le Cordon Bleu Paris, and was a teaching fellow as part of the Harvard Science and Cooking Program in 2012. She co-founded a successful pop-up series in Boston, called Gucci Midnight Ramen, directing back-of-the-house preparations as well as front-of-the-house service and hospitality. Chef Chang lives in Boston and is committed to creating opportunities for collaboration and innovation. And she has a very cute pug named Phoebe, which we'll talk about later. But Chef Chang, welcome to A Hungry Society.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
Thank you for being on the show. So, Pegu serves Japanese tapas. Can you kind of talk through your menu for listeners?
Sure. So it's always awkward when you have to correct someone and be like, well, it's actually Pagu. So Pagu is Japanese for pug, and pug is English for Pagu. And it's less so about checking all the boxes on, you know, Yelp and all the other sites of like, all right, are you small place? Are you tapas? Are you fusion? Are you Japanese and Spanish? Like, what kind of cuisine are you? It's more so about presenting an experience as if you were coming over to my home. So it's an extension of my living room, my kitchen. So the food is very homey. It's soulful, and it more or less tells a story about my cooking experiences with my family, as well as working abroad in Spain and growing up eating a lot of Japanese food in my grandmother's Japanese restaurant when I was a kid. And as we kind of evolve from there, we're now a year and 2 months old, and I understand that it's not going to be, you know, the next 10 to 20 years of telling my childhood stories and food memories, but also growing them with the current team that we have. Mm-hmm. We're evolving a bit from that now.
Yeah, so that living room bit is so interesting. So I read that you actually picked furniture and like decorations for the restaurant, like fully expecting people to come in and make it their own and like move things around.
Yeah, definitely. Part of the design decisions was, okay, will my mother be happy in any table, any chair, any, banquette in this room? And the other part of the decision was, okay, if we wanted to do this kind of event or this kind of party or this type of collaboration, how would we rearrange the furniture in the room? And that's where a lot of modular design decisions came to play. So it's interesting because I had a really, strong opinion, some people say, but also I pretty much had my hand in the cookie jar during every process of building and designing the restaurant.
Right. It's so interesting because I feel like most chefs are like very set on what they want an experience to look like, feel like, be like. And so it's just interesting that you approached Pagu with the spirit of it taking the form of whatever it needs to be for whoever comes in.
Yeah.
So, can you talk a little bit more about how you're thinking about the next 10, 20 years of, like, you know, not just yourself, but your team and, like, the stories that you want to tell through your food?
Yeah, definitely. One of the things about building Pagu is that it takes a lot of people. It takes a lot of time and energy. But it takes a lot of listening. And it took time to figure out, okay, where in the city do I open this? How big is it? okay, who are the people that we are serving? And that's, you know, that last part of who are the people that we are serving is the most important part, I think, because, you know, that's what keeps you in business. That's what keeps you motivated and excited to come in every day. And if you're not really listening to, you know, what people want or how they want it or why they want to come back, then, like, why are you in the business to begin with? So it's been really interesting as gathering feedback and in a way that, you know, an open conversation and in a way that people see that their opinions really matter, and that if I say, hey, like, here, try our new Spanish meatball special today, you know, we're working on the recipe and fine-tuning it, so, like, let me know what you think, that has real value to it. Just like if we're saying, hey, we're thinking to, you know, change up the artwork over here, like, what do you think about this? That, you know, again, their opinions matter, and when they see the results, they're like, oh, hey, like, I participated in that.
And this isn't your first, like, it's almost like unfair to call Pagu like your first restaurant, or foray into the restaurant world, because you had a very successful pop-up in Boston that you co-founded, right? Called Gucci's Midnight Ramen.
Yeah.
And it was so I lived in Boston for a long time, and it was just like you could not buy tickets to this ramen pop-up. Can you talk a little bit about how that started and like what you learned from that experience?
Yeah, definitely. First, I guess I apologize that you weren't able to get in. Hopefully you're one of like those very positive people that are like, oh, but I'll just go to Pagu now that they're open.
Right.
Instead of like the, oh, like the begrudgers that are like, I'll, you know, write them off and never go. You know, I don't think we have too many of those.
Right.
I think we still get people that are like, hey, I tried to get tickets like years ago to your pop-up. And I find it very endearing, and I get excited, like, I see they're glowing, and, you know, I think my eyes are kind of lit up to get to know them and understand, like, why they cared so much about it. But, yeah, so Gucci's Midnight Ramen was a pop-up that a couple of my former coworkers and I launched in, was it 2000? I think end of 2011. I had just come back from Spain after this kind of, like, emergency phone call that my dad was kind of sick. I came back and helped take care of him, and fortunately, he, like, miraculously got better in a month. But during that time, I was like, shoot, what am I doing? Like, should I go back to Spain? Like, I'm so bored. I went from working 15 hours a day to, you know, like, sitting here and making soup for Dad. Mm-hmm. And that's when, you know, we decided to make some soup for the rest of, you know, Boston and Cambridge, and make noodles and, you know, toppings and cookies and everything else that was on our menu, you know, braised pork belly bao, and everything was made from scratch. But what I realized was the value of creating these pop-ups, these experiences that not only were, okay, they started as, oh, I'm hungry, you're hungry, oh, like these other friends on Twitter and Instagram that are chefs and bartenders are also hungry, and it happens to be midnight, like, let's go cook at Bon Deer because he gave us his kitchen, or let's go cook at Sportello or the Gallows, or, you know, my friend's startup on a Sunday. Everyone craved, I guess, ramen, because that was, you know, one part being that was like the height of ramen in New York, and we really didn't have that many options in Boston. Mm-hmm. But I think people really craved like an experience to gather together, whether it was at midnight or midday or mid-afternoon, to bond over like tasty food, but also something more. Like that kind of fill in the blank was like all the different kind of collaborations we were doing at the time. And what was cool about that is it helped me realize like that I really did have a tribe back here in Boston and Cambridge. It helped me realize, like, ultimately, what did I want to do? Where did I want to open my restaurant? Who did I want to serve? And who were, you know, my close friends that would, like, help me do that, and who would continue on to be my collaborators in all these super creative ways. Mm-hmm. It really gave me a sense of purpose of, you know, like, again, why I do this to begin with. Like, why open a restaurant? It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
So you have to have a strong sense of purpose and remind yourself that it's all worth it every day.
Yeah, and speaking of that, you mentioned your dad a little bit, but your grandma owned a Japanese restaurant not too far from where you are now in Cambridge, and I read that you worked the cash register.
Yeah, we won't talk about childhood labor laws, but my grandmother
and family, I feel like it doesn't.
In the late 80s, yeah, to 2000, had Tokyo Restaurant, and it was in the Fresh Pond area of Cambridge. And that was a time where there were very few Japanese restaurants in the city. And she had what people would call an authentic Japanese restaurant, where the architecture, the the people that worked there, the chefs, like they were all, largely, most of them were Japanese. And I have these super fun memories of like scooping green tea ice cream, eating too much wasabi, making Shirley Temples. And at that time, I guess like restaurants were structured a little bit differently, that they would have this like big cash register by the door. And so it was where people would, enter and leave. And so I would get to chat them up and kind of check them out, but also really understand like who were these faces that were coming in, every week to my grandmother's restaurant. And I remember seeing like, oh, this big white shiny cello case. It was huge, right? Like I was tiny, and it's like this huge case. I was like, oh, I could fit in there and play hide and go seek in there. And my brothers and my cousins would never find me. It would be like Yo-Yo Ma coming in and living as cello there, or this like really really tall lady with a funny voice and curly hair that looks so familiar. And I was like, oh, I know, I've seen her on Channel 2, mm-hmm. and she's cooking. And it would be Julia Child, and she lived around the corner. And she really enjoyed Japanese food and Japanese like traditional wares, just like the kind of large different like sushi display things that we had. So I remember she and my grandmother would talk about that too. So those super fun memories that I know I could never like time travel and go back to, but I hope to recreate in a similar way something like that at Pagu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned child labor laws, and I feel like with family restaurants, like those just go out the window. Like it's all hands on deck, like everyone just jump in where you can to help out and like make the restaurant run.
Yeah. I wish it was a little bit like that now, but my family, my nieces are like 2 years old and 1 year old, so not yet.
So you also have mentioned how inspiring it was to watch your grandmother take care of her team, which was mostly, people who immigrated to the country. And she kind of built this family behind the scenes in her restaurant.
Yeah, I still remember very specific people. And I remember I was learning Spanish starting in the fourth grade, and I was speaking with Tony, one of the Guatemalan bartenders. I remember practicing my Spanish with him, and I remember practicing Japanese with some of the servers, and they would dress in traditional Japanese yukata with the geta, the wooden slippers, and the tabi, the socks that look kind of like mittens. And it was just like such a fun like melting pot of people there, and I don't know. I really appreciate that. That wasn't something that I could, go to school and do in the same way.
Mm-hmm. So, speaking of school, after Boston College, after a business degree, you went to Paris to go to Le Cordon Bleu.
Yes.
Was the intention to eventually do like your own restaurant or work with other chefs? Like what was the impetus for going to culinary school after business school?
Yeah. So I originally started pre-med in college, because I thought I would become a surgeon. And then I became really disenchanted with just how the medical system worked and how, mm-hmm. As an intern or as, someone being on the front line in terms of like working reception and being the first person to interact with someone that needed help, I had to turn them away because they didn't have health insurance. So I kind of was jaded because I wouldn't in my lifetime be able to create, I think, any real system changes that would you know, unless I lived in a third world country, that would really serve the people in that way. So, you know, I studied something practical like finance, and, you know, my mom was always kind of in my ear about, oh, you know, do consulting, you like to travel, you like case studies, you're good at math, you're good with numbers, you like spreadsheets, which is all true and still true to a certain extent. But I always wanted to study languages, so I continued practicing my Spanish, but also took an intensive French course my last year at Boston College. And then I also took a job at OYA, which started as, you know, I guess just being kind of lucky, getting my foot in the door and saying, hey, like, I would love to host here. And then, you know, bringing them a bunch of sample treats that I'd made at home. I was like, but really, like, I would love an opportunity to learn how to cook here. And these are, you know, here's a little portfolio of 23 dishes that I really, you know, love to make at home. And, you know, I never ended up hosting there, but I worked, you know, there full time for a year and decided, okay, like, I really don't need to look back. I, like, this is what I enjoy. Like, I'm don't need to be rolling in the dough to enjoy what I do or to know what I enjoy doing. And so I decided to go to France for pastry school because I wanted some real formal training. I actually wanted to get yelled at. I thought, like, oh, if I go to France, like, they're very disciplined. They're very French. They're, you know, they're all about technique. And I will get some serious training. I will get some serious, like, butt kicking there. Hmm. And they were a lot nicer than I thought. It was pretty nice. So then from France, I went to Spain to a 3-star Michelin restaurant with Martin Berasategui. And Martin had trained in France, so he, of course, had that same, you know, very, like, regimented, like, very, you know, Basque is quite different than Spanish. So it was an intense kitchen. That's where the yelling was. That's where the discipline, the exigence was. And I think when you get to play ball at that level, it's like you're almost addicted to the intensity. Mm-hmm. But you've probably heard that before, right? Like, you've heard that chefs are, like, adrenaline addicts or something.
Oh,
right?
Definitely. I always tell people that chefs are basically just moody artists. And that's why the celebrity chef thing is always kind of funny to me. Because chefs, you know, in the kitchen can be, you know, yelling and very regimented, like you said, or, you know, completely silent and completely focused on a brunoise of something, you know, it's, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very artsy sort of thing. Do you yell in your kitchen now?
I really don't need to. I, like, since opening, I can't remember how many times I've actually had to raise my voice, which is great. It might be because I'm, like, losing my hearing and it just sounds all, you know, nice. But no, I really don't think I need to. I loved, like, I really enjoyed having a structured, a very rigid training. I don't think it's my style of leadership. I had, like, two very, well, like, probably three, but, like, I had very opposite ends of the spectrum kind of training. Like, one very hands-off, passive-aggressive. Very, like, flowy, I trust you, like, you do it. Oh, this isn't, like, really what I wanted. Like, here, let me leave you a sticky note about what I wanted. Let me email you. And then I had a very, like, what is this? Like, you know, throw it in your face, throw it in the trash, like, redo it. Like, let me burn your hand and show you how it's done.
Oh, my God.
Kind of training. And I don't think any, like, either of those are my style. Mm-hmm. You know, appreciate the insights I've gained from learning from those people. I respect them. But my style is very much, I think, more human and more appropriate to the workforce that we have, you know, right now in 2018. And I don't know. I don't know if I should compare it to parenting because I don't have, like, real kids. I just have these play, like, pretend restaurant, I guess, kids or employees, and I have, you know, two dogs, mm-hmm. so I don't know how to liken it, but, you know, I think it's just speaking directly with people, like, is this clear, like, this is, you know, how I want it, this is why, like, I think it's important to explain why to people, and let me show you. And, you know, then you show me back so I know that you know, what we're talking about. Mm.
That's great. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more Chef Tracy Chang of Pagu.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. From papayas and samosas to reishi mushrooms, if it's something that sounds delicious, chances are you'll find the freshest, best version of it at Whole Foods Market. They have more than 400 stores across the country, so if you consider pizza its own food group or just can't imagine when avocado toast wasn't a thing, Whole Foods Market has you covered. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com to find a store near you. Whole Foods Market. Whatever makes you whole.
All right, so we're back with Chef Tracy Chang of Pagu. So your grandmother had this restaurant in Cambridge. Did you and your family go out to eat a lot, or did you eat at home mostly?
We would go to her restaurant at least once a week, if not twice. And then we would cook at home a lot of the other nights. My parents both work a lot, and they still do. But it was nice that we always sat around the table and had, you know, a meal to share at 5 o'clock every day. That I thought was, you know, pretty well balanced. The only times that we did was like might be for certain occasions. Like there was this one restaurant in Chinatown called East Ocean City, which happened to have closed last year. After many years in business, we would go there. My grandfather liked the seafood there. And we would also go to, you know, like occasionally if we happened to run errands or go shopping, like during the holidays, we would go to Legal Seafoods. I remember being in the mall back when Legal Seafoods was a couple of, was not in airports, but now it's everywhere.
Yeah, that is, I feel like that's so like quintessential, like New England childhood is to go to Legal Seafoods with your family.
It was so good, those bread rolls.
Yeah. I still would eat those and the clam chowder, to be honest.
And the chowder. Yeah, I grew up lactose intolerant, and I was like, I will suffer because it's so good.
What kind of dishes did your family make at home?
We're pretty traditional at home, except for when I obviously introduced, you know, all these things that I've been recipe testing. But we eat pretty healthily. We like to eat a lot of seafood and veggie. And we eat quite a bit of like Taiwanese food, so it's like steamed whole fish with a little bit of Shaoxing wine and ginger scallion, and a touch of like soy sauce or sesame oil or hot oil on top. It's pea pod stem with sautéed garlic. It's pretty traditional, pretty healthy. Some of those kinds of dishes you'll see actually on the menu. So like our sticky rice chicken, that's actually a Cornish hen deboned and stuffed with sticky rice. We have that at Pagu because my Aunt Jin's recipe. It's just one of, I don't know, it's always a family favorite, and we do it like large format in a turkey for Thanksgiving. And we like to do it here at Pagu, and it's nice to see that other people enjoy it too. And now they're coming in regularly for the sticky rice hen, and I'm like, oh, like they didn't have this in childhood, but it's nice that they, you know, they now have this kind of, I don't know, like memory created with us that might be akin to something that I love about the memory with my aunt and my family, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like one of the, I'll say the most photographed dish that I've seen from your restaurant is the squid ink bun, and that's kind of a play on the buns that you grew up eating, like the traditional like Taiwanese buns. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. My grandmother used to make traditional Chinese Taiwanese dishes for us, and you can't really find that kind of stuff in restaurants. I'm not really sure why. I mean, Taiwan is a very small place. And so maybe that's why, but it's, you know, the baos are quite traditional and they're like street food in Taiwan, but it's interesting because they can be street food And they can also be like three-star Michelin kind of food. And at Pavio, you know, we just try and keep it super honest, and it's my family's recipe. And I don't think you need to be like zero stars or three stars to enjoy it and appreciate it. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's really just nostalgic and delicious.
What other dishes besides the Cornish hen and the bun do you love on your menu?
There's so many things because everything has a story.
Right.
I wonder if like my Pagu team is like sick of hearing it. So I'm like, oh, so this is when in college, like my friends and I decided to do this, and they asked me to make, you know, a matcha dessert, and I decided to make matcha cookies. But everything has a story to it. Like the childhood fried rice, like what I would practice making every Sunday with my family, and then we would have like fried rice showdowns between cousins and uncles. But then really my cousins just wanted to judge, so then I'd be competing with my uncles trying to make a better fried rice than they did. And I remember making some really wonky ones. Like I made, at this one point, I really like tuna fish, like canned tuna fish, like what is it, like Chicken of the Sea or Jumbo, mm-hmm. or whatever those brands are. And I made a tuna fish fried rice, and my cousin will never let it down. She's like, Trace, just remember, like, one day when you made it, just remember that you used to make tuna fish fried rice.
Did it come out good, or was it bad?
I thought it was delicious. I mean, if I was challenged right now to recreate that, I bet I could make a very tasty tuna fried rice. I still believe in it. Like, I don't know if that one tasted good, but, you know, I still believe in it.
Right. So maybe one day on the Pagu menu, there will be a tuna fried rice. And you can then tell your staff that story, too. You can add that in.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is about, like, sharing those, like, fun stories and really meaningful, delicious, like, homey dishes. But one of the other things in terms of, I don't know, I guess, like, that kind of comment about tuna fish fried rice, is that we're, like, I always say we're in the business of, you know, like, yeah, we're in the business of making people happy, you know, of, like, creating memorable experiences, of sharing food and drink, but we're also in the business, at least I am, of changing preconceived notions, because I find that to be one of the most, like, exciting, challenging, and rewarding parts of my job as a chef. It's like, how can, you know, I... create something that you already think is going to be terrible because you hate, you know, fill in the blank, like eggplants or tuna fish or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And how can I make that like delicious for you? So you'll now have, you know, this awesome memory, but also like you'll give it a chance somewhere else. Because I was a picky eater as a kid, and, you know, there were certainly moments and dishes and people who changed my mind. And I think that's really powerful. And I think that if we can do that, then, you know, then more people will be more open and surprise themselves.
Is that a lot of pressure to put on yourself? Like, does that feel heavy at all to want to, like, change people's, the preconceived notions that they may have about an ingredient or a dish or even a cuisine?
I mean, I think that if they came in the door, like, they're already doing their part to try, right? If they're sitting in the seat, they have food in front of them, like, they already signed up for like, half the bottle. And I think that, you know, that's them showing that they're here to participate and that they're giving it a chance. I think it's up to us to, you know, to explain it in the right way and to, you know, make it taste good. Also to listen to the feedback about what they might not enjoy about it. If it's, you know, scientific and it's cilantro, then, you know, like, that's tough. Like, then I won't continue to serve, like, you know, raw cilantro to someone that doesn't like cilantro.
Right.
But if I'm, like, making a cilantro oil or puree or sauce, and I think that adaptation can perhaps, you know, change someone's preconceived notion about it, then I will continue to try there.
Mm. So when you're not at Pagu, where are you going to eat? Like, what are some of your favorite restaurants right now?
Yeah, Cafe Sushi. Have you been there?
I love, love, love that place. I'm so happy for Seiji.
That is like my number one because I live down the street. because Seiji and Kenshi and Leslie and Mori-san and Guillermo and everyone, like everyone there is just like,
they're so nice.
They took care of me when I was building the restaurant, and I would go in like a zombie and be like, oh my God, I haven't eaten anything. Like my hair is dusty from construction and I, you know, like everything about me is kind of like dirty and exhausted right now. Let me eat something, you know, homey and nourishing. And they're so great there.
Yeah. Anywhere else?
Yeah, Pammy's also down the street from us. Awesome, like love their natural wine, natural wine list, and I love how it's not like super, super traditional Italian, but it's like twist on a classic, which is quite similar to, you know, to our ethos. And it's like, you know, it's homey, it's soulful. The ambiance there is so warm. Like the decoration is like, you don't feel like you're in Boston. If you're thinking like typical Boston restaurants and restaurant design, you feel definitely transported by the decor and the warmth in there, not just because they have a fireplace. They're really wonderful people there. Copa, I love. Bar Mitsana in the South End. I do occasionally make it to the other side of the river, and my good friends there always take care of me. Like Colin Lynch and Heather Lynch at Bar Mitsana are the ones who helped me do a lot of pop-ups, and I love what they're doing there. They have, you know, always made delicious food and always taken care of me and my friends, and I'm excited to see them open another place across the street now. They're doing a tiki bar.
Oh, wow.
And Copa. Like, Copa, you don't know, like, what country are you in right now, right? Like, you're not necessarily in the South End. It's super intimate. And Jamie and Ken have always made, like, such delicious food. And can't go wrong. Like, I always take visiting chefs there, especially before they go to the airport. Like, they would come for Harvard Science and Cooking, and they'd be like, oh, like, can we go back to Copa? Like, I want to go there right before I go to the airport, and I want to eat, like, you know, three or four different half portions of all the different pastas, and, you know, take pizza for my plane ride. So they always get so excited. So I think that's, like, a good tell of, like, an awesome restaurant. It's, like, you know, that other chefs feel that way about your food, that they even want to take it on the airplane to go back to their country.
So those are your favorites. Can you talk about one of the worst dining experiences you've ever had?
Yeah, that I've ever had. So it was in Taiwan. Is that okay?
Yeah, totally
fine. Another country.
That's okay.
I can't name it because I don't remember the name, but it was somewhere in the middle of nowhere in Taiwan. And what was really sad about it is that my mom's cousin, so I guess my uncle, had been taking us around for a couple of days, and he was bringing us to the best places, but like seafood market, hole in the wall places. And like, we were just eating such good products that was like unpretentious, just straight up good food created by, you know, mom and pop. And then he was like, he kept talking about this one restaurant that he's going to take us to for dinner that was in the middle of nowhere. It's supposed to be very enchanting and some beautiful, you know, space. And so we drove up to it, and, you know, it was quite an experience to get there, right? That's like building up. And we get there, it's completely remote, and we're all like salivating as he kind of like hyped up this place. And it's a beautiful building. And then when you walk in, it was, like, so dramatic. Like, the space immediately was, like really bright lights, like, really tall ceilings, cement pillars. The dishes, like, the whole design of the place, like, really matched with how stuffy, like, the food and the service was. Like, it was big white plates with really sparse food, a lot of garnish, a lot of, like, food coloring. And then, like, LEDs, it was really confusing, like, LED lights that were hidden in the food. and so you could, like, as soon as you, like, walked in and sat down, you, like, felt it, like, in the air, you breathed it, but also, like, you felt it on, you know, the table and, like, the glass over the table and the, like, really starchy, crunchy, you know, napkins that they had. And it made me really sad because the service didn't make it any better. It was really stuffy, and he had hyped this up, and I was like, well, what happened to all those really great hole-in-the-wall places, right? It's like, it really shows you that, like, it's not about this ostentatious, like, design of a place or, like, the idea of a place, but the actual just, like, execution. Like, is it solid? And I just wanted to go back to those, like, tiny places that we had gone, like, to the one man that only roasted yams in a steel drum, and the fisherman at the pier that had, like, fish and shrimp jumping out of his buckets, or the noodle lady who, like, had to convince me to eat the one thing that she served, which is, like, thin rice noodles with pig intestines, which you're like, oh, that doesn't sound, you know, great. But then you have it, and you're like, oh, my God, I can't stop. So that was... that was, like, pretty off-putting. I don't think I've been in a place that has made me feel that way since. But
that's good.
we still trust our uncle to a certain extent.
So my last question for you, if you could have your last meal in a restaurant, where would it be and who is invited?
All right. And I can time travel?
Yes. And it doesn't have to be people that... you know, are still alive. It can be anyone. It could be celebrities. It could be family member that's passed away. It's anyone.
Okay. Well, I think it's, like, pretty obvious. I'm like, not, I don't know. I guess, like, after hearing my story, it's kind of obvious that it would be my grandmother. And if possible, you know, everyone else in the family. And I just have this, like, really fond memory of, like, a specific time at the restaurant, which would be New Year's Eve at Tokyo Restaurant, and all the families there, all the chefs, you know, the Guatemalan bartenders and the Japanese, like, BU students, and they're all dressed up and they're, you know, in, like, traditional Japanese garb. But also my grandmother would give me this giant tray of red envelopes, and it was tradition to give out red envelopes filled with money in Chinese, for Chinese Lunar New Year. So we would do that for, December 31st. And everyone was happy because, you know, you're throwing a big party, people are dancing, you know, they're eating, they're drinking, but also you have an opportunity to open a little red envelope. It could be, you know, $5, $10, but it could also be $100.
Wow.
So I thought that was a lot of fun. That was, like, way better than scratch tickets, because you know you're going to win.
Right.
And I thought that was, like, really nice that my grandmother did that for folks, because it, you know, it really brings everyone together, not just over, like, food and drink, but, like, to really thank them in a, like, exciting kind of, you know, tradition. So I miss that.
Yeah, I think you should, well, one, that sounds like a great way to go out, and two, you should definitely, like, recreate that at Pagu. I think that's really cool.
I know. I just thought you just gave me that idea as I was saying. I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to do this. I was like, Chinese New Year was last week.
Yeah, but I mean.
You can still do it.
Yeah, you can still do it. I think that'd be a good time. I think the pugs have to be there. And, I mean, I'm going to ask for an invite on air.
Definitely. Definitely. And I know you mentioned earlier, like, oh, and her one pug, Phoebe, but I also have,
you have
a puppy
two.
Now. So
yes.
My puppy, Pearl. So.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was great. It was a lot of fun.
And thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you next time on The Hungry Society.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
ever wonder what kind of podcast Julia Child would have made? Probably would have been one where she introduced you to all of her latest discoveries and favorite people. And that's exactly the tradition we're following on Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. Join me, Todd Shulkin, your host, and the Foundation's Executive Director, as I bring you inside the Foundation's world to meet the bright lights of today's food universe, just as Julia used to do from her own famous kitchen. New episodes air on Heritage Radio Network, Wednesdays at noon Eastern. Listen in.